Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Karen. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I think we have had to reschedule this a couple of times, but I'm looking forward to this. This is actually our last recording in 2020, and this will actually air in early 2021. Before we dive into our topic today, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast today. I'm excited to finally talk to you. We've been going through this back and forth for a little bit, and it's a great way to end the year talking about some important fundraising topics.
Yes, so Karen.
Tell you a little bit about who I am. My name is Karen Paul. I'm a practicing fundraiser. I've been in the nonprofit sector for now a little over 20 years. I've been a practicing fundraiser for 10 years in a lot of different roles, from social services to arts and culture, and I've worked in a lot of different environments as an employee, as a volunteer, and I'm passionate about fundraising. I'm a certified fundraising executive. I have my CFRE. I've served in some volunteer roles with AFP, and I love talking about this stuff, so I'm excited to talk to you.
So you said you've officially sort of been in fundraising for 10 years. Are you of that sort? So one of the things that with the first book that I published, I was actually writing to the 10-year veteran, the person who was sort of beyond the fundraising 101, who in some ways was getting frustrated with some of the workshops that they would go to at conferences because they were oftentimes repetitive and sometimes, you know, elementary, I guess you might say. Are you one of those people, Karen, that's starting to think very critically about the work that we do? And have some bold opinions about things? Is that sort of where you're at, where you would say you're at in your career?
Absolutely. And then having, so I was in marketing for 10 years and then moved over to fundraising for the last 10 years. And when you start looking at the nonprofit sector as a whole, it's been through a lot of changes. But fundraising in general, I think, is going to go through a lot more changes. We've been through a lot in the last 10 years, but I think the sector is about to do some major pivots coming up.
And one more question to sort of get your introduction done a little more. It's interesting you say you spent some time in marketing. Do you
Do you think you identify better with fundraising than you do perhaps with marketing? Is there a reason why maybe you made that transition? And do you think you'll stick it out with fundraising for the rest of your career?
I hope so. I love fundraising. I think it's one of the few things I've done where I bring together all of these skill sets and get to use them in a point where I get to help others. And that's really what we're trying to do, is to better leverage our missions and to help people. And I love that component of it. And I truly love the profession. I think it's some of the most talented people I've met in this field.
Well, I like it when I hear the word love. I oftentimes hear that. I wouldn't say I hear it often, but I periodically with guests hear the word love. And I always pay very close attention to what my guests are attaching the word love to. So I appreciate, I do really enjoy and love the work that we do as well. What are we going to talk about today?
So let's talk about where we're going as a profession and some of the challenges we've experienced for the year and what we think the profession is going to look like, especially in light of turnover and staffing, because I think that's one of the things that I'm the most passionate about. Is I love the people that we're working with because they're doing some incredible work, and it's a tough time to be a fundraiser. And I don't know, even in the best of circumstances, it's a tough time. And I'm not sure what that's going to mean for the profession going forward, but I think it's going to lead to some major changes.
So where do you think it's going? I've got some opinions about that, but I'll let you, we'll get you warmed up on your opinions, and then I'll see if I can throw you some curveballs on your thinking.
Absolutely. So what do we think about turnover? Because consistently turnover is one of the things that comes up. It is since day one that I've been a fundraiser, we've talked about turnover, and turnover has steadily, that window keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And some of the latest studies I've seen have put that our average tenure at a job at anywhere from, 18 to 24 months, which is such a short amount of time when you're talking about a role that requires relationship building and long-term investments. Anyone who says they walk in and they close, $100,000 gift at a new organization probably inherited a lot of stuff from someone else that they're working.
Right.
But it makes them look good for the short term. But, all of us who are fundraisers know that's not realistic.
Yeah.
And with everyone moving all the time, you have to wonder if we ever get to a point where we get this sort of long-term stability that comes from having long-term fundraisers in place. And then if you're looking at the pandemic on top of it, the pressures that we're all facing from the pandemic, is that going to accelerate the turnover? Are we going to get to a point where people are just staying, a year or year and a half in a position? Because does that really accomplish anything?
I have wondered, Karen, I've wondered a couple of times if as we turn the corner on 2021, as it relates to this question of turnover, if we're going to see some transition, in particular because, very specifically because individuals, so individuals like yourself, myself, who are working for the local, SPCA or rescue mission or human services organization, whoever they happen to be working for, are perhaps going to leave because they came to the realization during 2020 just how unprepared their employers were to navigate the unpredictability of what was 2020. What's your thoughts on that?
I think some of that will happen. I think there's going to be a point where some people are, let's be honest, if you're in an arts and cultural organization right now, didn't have a major event, you didn't have a major fundraiser, a lot of these organizations aren't going to be sustainable. And it's not because their people didn't do the work ahead of time. It's just if they weren't prepared for the challenges that were coming, that put a lot of pressure on fundraisers. And so there may be some people who decide that this is not what they want to do anymore either. I think we'll see people who are really spending a lot of time looking at, is the work aligning with their mission, their personal missions, and deciding to make changes. We may also see some people who are deciding to completely step out of fundraising.
Because do you think 2020 was sort of a proving year? So it in effect, it actually could perhaps reduce the turnover because the people who do sort of see themselves let's say the people who do exit the profession in the next, say, 12 months. So in 2021, those may be the people who they finally just sort of, it was the last straw for them. They sort of hit the point where they said, this is just not me. I cannot endure this type of work. Do you think that maybe the people that we hold on to through 2021 may actually be the, you know, their stamina, their stick-to-itiveness? There was a conversation I recently had with another guest, the idea of stick-to-itiveness. I don't know that. I think some of the turnover that we have in this field is we don't have a lot of people who just know how to stick to it. They don't know how to ride that. They don't know how to ride that roller coaster of what it is to raise money, like fundraising is.
No, I absolutely think that's right. I think we have, because we don't always have the best pathways into the profession. A lot of us just sort of accidentally end up as fundraisers.
Yeah.
And we, I think for people who don't know what they're getting into fully, sometimes it's a shock. It's not all fancy events. It's not all big checks. It's not all these big moments. Like, those big moments have 100 small moments that get to it. And for someone who really wants the big moments, that's hard. That's a lot of, it takes a lot of stamina to get to the big moments. And I don't know that everyone is ready for that. And the maturity, it's a field that requires a lot of emotional maturity, because you have to kind of step out of who you are to serve your donors the best way possible. Because you really have to be thinking about them and taking care of them in order to fulfill the mission.
Okay. I don't think I've had a single guest. Now, we're broadcasting somewhere in the early 200s right now. I don't think I have had many guests who've made that statement, that fundraising is a, I think they've sort of skirted around it, and perhaps a couple have alluded to that. But I really appreciate the idea, Karen, that fundraising is a type of work that requires a lot of emotional maturity.
Well, that's just me. I don't know that it's something that I could have done in my early 20s. I don't know if I was emotionally mature enough to sit down with a donor who was in their 70s or 80s and thinking about an estate plan, or their sort of philanthropic giving in terms of their faith, or that sort of like longevity. I don't know that I had the maturity to even know where they were coming from at that point, because it's such a different perspective. And early in your career, or at least early in my career, you know, I wanted the wins. I wanted those sort of moments. And that's not right. How you get to the bigger things in fundraising.
And maybe that's
just me. I just don't know that I could have done that in my early 20s.
I'm working on a book project, and you've got me thinking about some of the things that I'm currently writing, and I'm right there with you. You know, I've had some very recent guests who like to sort of hinge a lot of this. And honestly, and some of them are going to take issue with this, I'm sure, if they're listening. But some of this comparing, this comparison that we oftentimes do in this line of work, where we're comparing it to sales and marketing and PR and so forth. Mm-hmm. And there's an author, Rob Patton is his name. I think he's one of our, you know, guys who's been around a long time in the field. And he talks about how fundraising oftentimes only gets to be known by metaphors, because we're oftentimes always comparing ourselves to something else because we don't know who we are. And where it gets to, Karen, is exactly what you're landing on. And it's this idea. I've been looking at Erickson's sort of human development, the way that we develop as human beings. And I've compared it oftentimes to the way where the fundraising profession finds itself. And it's the idea that we're stuck in this messy adolescence and we can't seem to get over the hump and transition into being young adults, which happens to be, and Erickson would have told us this, that's that time period when you think about being in middle school and high school, where you have these identity crises, and we sort of clump into these cliques, and it's all about our identity. So it's not about competency anymore. It's not about, can you get the job done? Most young people in high school know, hey, I can pass my science class. I can get my math class done. It's not a competency question. It's a question of maturity and identity. Can I be this person that I want to be in the world? Unpack that with me some more.
No, but I think that's a very valid thing because we often, part of the complication is that we are not necessarily, we're having to define the profession in terms of in conjunction with other people. So we're having to do that in conjunction with, you know, what executive directors want from the fundraising role, what boards want from the fundraising role. And I think when it comes to sales, sales is really attractive if you have a sales background, because people who are salespeople can talk a great game. They can talk great numbers. I'm not sure that that's always translatable into what we face on a day-to-day basis in the profession. Because I've worked with donors that if I had gone in with a sales approach, like this idea that we have to close, we have to do, we would have lost them a long time ago.
Yeah.
Because someone who's, you know, back to an 80-year-old donor who's doing an estate plan, they don't want to close. They're having to think their way through a lot of different things to get to their end result. Their goal is not the same as mine to walk out in the meeting with a commitment. And it shouldn't, and my goal shouldn't matter. My goal is secondary to what they want to do. Because in the end, we want to take care of them. Because if they're already thinking about us, they'll take care of the organization if they care about it. And our job is to support them in what they need to do that. It's not to give them a hard sales pitch.
So and before we hit the roof.
I think we're having to manage that a lot. And part of it too is because most of us have accidentally kind of come into this profession. There's a little bit of a sorting out amongst ourselves on what we think it needs to look like too. And we often disagree about that.
So it's interesting, before we hit the record button, you suggested as we were sort of briefing on what we would be talking about today, and now where we've sort of sort of this halfway point in this conversation, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this. And I bring this up quite often. I oftentimes say, Karen, that I think that the skills that I learned from my mother versus those things that I learned from my father better prepared me, the more feminine side of who I am. Because, you know, I'm certainly acknowledging that we all sort of have this masculine and feminine side to us. And we typically get that from our parents, if from anyone else. I tend to think that the best fundraisers are not so much to say that they are women, but they definitely know how to tap into those skills that they perhaps learned from their mother. What's your thoughts on that?
I think that would align with what we see in the profession, where the profession has shifted predominantly to women.
Yeah.
There's an overwhelming majority of women in the profession, necessarily in those upper leadership positions, which is something we all need to work on. But as a whole, with women in the profession, I think as women, we kind of are trained and nurtured to have better listening skills. And I
think
that listening skills is such an important part of what we need to be able to do as fundraisers. And I think that goes back to the maturity part we were talking about. Active listening isn't something we're all born with. That's kind of something we learn along the way and we nurture and it grows. That's a maturity component, because a lot of times when you're young in any profession, you want to talk a lot. You want to kind of be able to step in and have that place where you're demonstrating your competence. And that's not necessarily always aligned with active listening. Sometimes the best thing you can do is just sort of stop talking and listen to what your donor has to say.
Okay, so let me throw you a curveball. I always like to get, once we get past the halfway point in my conversations, I like to, but I'm sensing that you obviously think through this as much as I do.
No, I'm serious about this. I'm not just talking. I mean, I really love this stuff.
I know you do. That's what I'm picking up on. So I'm of the opinion that some of the voices, some of the female voices, the women voices in our space right now, have taken on too many of those masculine traits. Let's call it the salesy type traits, those very aggressive salesmanship type characteristics that perhaps are either a sign of immaturity, but perhaps just simply a more masculine sort of aggressive way to do these sorts of things. And And I often wonder if that's perhaps some of what is sort of holding back the profession collectively, because you've got lots of voices. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about voices that, you know, they've essentially propped up consulting firms and so forth, like I'm doing. But when you hinge so much on salesmanship and marketing and aggressive, quote unquote, sales tactics, it's just not. There's not a certain degree of emotional intelligence, which is sort of where this conversation is sort of centering. And I think some of the women, to loop back to what my comment is, I think some of the women who have voices, who have platforms in our space, have inadvertently and unfortunately taken on sort of that platform in a way that perhaps if they would have just held on to who they were, we might be better for it. Does that make sense?
It does. I'm not sure if I agree with you on that part. I think
okay.
Trying to, at a certain point, I don't know, the upper levels of the profession are so male dominated.
Yeah.
I think that it's a hard fit for women to move up into that. I think that's something okay. The profession as a whole has to work on, because when you look at the statistics, there are more women in the profession than men.
Yeah.
The balance is way off. But when you get to those upper levels, the balance is way off where it's mostly men in those roles. And so,
okay, but see, that's what my issue is. That's essentially the issue I'm trying to sort of take issue with, is I think that, so you're saying that in our profession, like in a lot of professions, there's a lot, it's a very male-dominated sort of space.
In the upper level leaderships, yes.
Right. Right. Okay. And I think some of our women leaders, have tried too hard to compete with those fellas to the fault of actually, I guess that's sort of what I'm getting at.
But when you're having to work as a woman working in that sphere, you have to take on, I mean, it's, you're facing so many other barriers.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's any way around that yet, until we have a real reckoning about the profession and how that balance works. And I don't agree with either one, because I wish that our upper levels were far more representative. I think it would be more representative and more inclusive, and it would be a stronger profession if we had more room for women of all ages and races to be in those upper levels.
Oh, that's pretty deep, right? That's an interesting, right? I mean, that's the maturity thing that you're talking about. Yeah. That's that emotional intelligence that you're talking about. If we don't, until our profession sort of gets to that place where a woman or a person of color, where someone other than a straight white male like myself can sort of rise to those places, demonstrate a level of emotional maturity and carry out the work and close that quote unquote, close that gift with that $80 year old donor. The profession's still going to be in what I call its messy adolescence.
No. And I think that's absolutely true, because there are women doing phenomenal, amazing work in the profession, who are just as competent, but are not having those pathways to the upper leadership levels.
Okay, so let's, before we wrap up today, I want to hear what's holding those women back.
I don't have the answer to that. I mean, I don't have the answer to that. I am excited that AFP has put together some women's impact initiative.
Yes, they have. Right.
Projects, which are great. They're doing some amazing stuff. AFP is doing some phenomenal work, especially the latest thing they did on the salary requirements for the positions they're posting, which is going to help move equity in the profession forward tremendously. I like that AFP is going out on a limb and making those commitments, because that's what's going to move the profession forward. And it's going to take a combination of AFP with leadership in the profession to make some of these changes.
So is 2021 going to help get us there? Because that's sort of where we started. We started on this idea of turnover. And we've sort of come full circle, come back around. You know, we've sort of wandered into this issue that has been of regular conversation with a lot of my guests. Is the sort of the unpredictable ambiguity nature of what 2020 might look like going to actually improve those? Is it going to be a maturing year for us?
I hope so. We're seeing some progress through the work AFP is doing. The salary requirements on the positions that are being posted is tremendous. Will help, you know, that alone will help move equity forward, because that's going to remove a lot of barriers that exist as to how people are getting paid. And part of the turnover issue, where people are having to leave to find better salary support. I'm hopeful that as we move forward, that's going to happen, that we will start to see some of the collective impact of these changes.
How are you going to answer that question? I don't know, other than knowing that you're a 10-year fundraiser, I don't know who your boss is, I don't know who your direct reports are, but how are you going to know a year from now that we have emotionally matured at a very local, at the micro level, at your organization? How are you going to be able to answer that question?
I think we'll be able to answer that question when we start to see more people coming into the profession. Uh-huh. When we start to see a longer tenure at the positions that are in our community, because we would like to, every community wants to see a little bit longer tenure out of everyone.
Sure.
And I think just some general support and standardization, because even in local communities, there's a huge difference between what people are getting paid and what's happening. You know, there's a lot of difference. And if we can get to a point where it's a little bit more equitable, it benefits us all. And it benefits the profession, because stability will benefit the profession.
Is there, you know, one thing we haven't talked about, so let's talk about the, before I let you go, what about the Hispanic male, for example? You know, I mean, I don't know that I know too many. I know some African-American men, for example, and I know plenty of white women and white guys. But like, for example, the Hispanic male in fundraising, how do we... how does that sort of factor in?
But I think we have to create an environment that makes it more welcoming for everyone to come in.
Yeah.
I think you hit on something that's important too. We can talk a lot about women's diversity.
Yes.
In the profession, but ultimately we're two white people talking about a profession that is predominantly white too. And we're missing a lot of opportunities, especially as we're working with nonprofits that are serving underprivileged communities.
Sure.
There are opportunities there where we need to be more inclusive. Are we not creating an environment that's welcoming to someone who's, you know, not middle class and white? Or where are the barriers and how do we eliminate those? Because again, equity and diversity help us all. And it makes the profession stronger.
Yeah.
Truly believe that.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we also have a responsibility as white fundraisers to be more open to the challenges that our colleagues are facing and listen to things that they're experiencing, because there are places where AFP has done a great job this year at opening up some pathways for diverse voices to talk.
Yeah.
And some of the things that some of our fellow, you know, our colleagues have shared have been absolutely heartbreaking to me. And as white fundraisers, we have a responsibility to help eliminate those barriers for them and to make it where it's some of the stuff that they're dealing with should never have happened. If you go back and you listen to the recordings that a lot of our African-American colleagues have done and if you had shared, I mean, their experiences, that stuff should not exist in the workplace. And if we don't know that it's happening, we need to be creating the relationships to know that that stuff is happening so that we can help stop it, because it shouldn't be happening.
Yeah. If I'm not connecting the dots between some of those stories, and I suspect that some of my listeners, I speaking for myself, I think I am connecting the dots, but for some of my listeners who perhaps are not as aware of what some of those stories are, can you just share some of those details?
Absolutely, before I let you go. I don't want to necessarily like share their story because I think it's their story, and I want to be really respectful of it. But early in the 2020, AFP did a series of conversations with some of the leading African American women voices in our profession, where they talked about some of the instances of racism, sexism, and just complete discrimination that they had faced as fundraisers in the profession.
Right.
And the stories were absolutely heartbreaking, absolutely shocking, and I'm assuming fairly commonplace, because when you're talking about a panel of women sharing their stories and none of the other panelists were surprised by the stories, that's, it really should never have existed. When you're talking, you know, overt racism, inappropriate comments, none of that should be something that we tolerate as a profession for women who are incredibly talented and doing amazing work.
Right. And is it internal? Is it, are they internal part of the tension that I see consistently in this particular discussion is whether or not it's internal challenges. So it's the relationship between you, the woman leader in the development seat, for example, working for a gentleman, or it's the relationship externally with the donor. Are these stories more often the direct interaction with the donor, or are we talking about inside the office?
Oh, I think it's probably both in a lot
of cases. It's both, yes.
Which I think is part of the challenge, is that it's happening in all aspects of fundraising. And it doesn't create a very welcoming environment for people who want to stay. If you're facing those challenges on a daily basis, why would you stay? And I think the women who have shared their stories believe in the profession, believe in the work they're doing, and believe in speaking out to make a difference. And I'm incredibly proud of them for opening up that dialogue across AFP, because I know for me, it was incredibly eye-opening.
And you think it's wiser, or you think it's possible that, for example, a 35-year-old woman coming into the... that it's possible that a 35-year-old woman coming into the work is perhaps more emotionally mature than, say, for example, a lot of the guests that I have had in the last year have been probably in their early 20s, and they've been in their first position. And those are the people who perhaps are not really ready to tackle some of the things I think you're talking about.
Oh, I would absolutely agree with that, because I think... And I don't know if they even have those experiences necessarily. I think an older woman looks at those experiences differently. And I think there's a protectiveness we have for a lot of our younger colleagues about some of those issues because of things that we've gone through or that we have colleagues who have gone through.
Right. You've got me thinking, and that's what the best guess that I have usually get me thinking very critically about this, because we just recently had a conversation about longevity that did really well and got a lot of listeners, and you've got me thinking perhaps the woman that we interviewed, for example, Karen, the woman that we interviewed is a woman. She's working for a fraternity that's a male fraternity. You know, it's for men, but she's been in the role for nearly 20 years. Shortly after college, I think, is sort of how her story works. And she's constantly interacting with, obviously, for obvious reasons, she's constantly interacting with men because it's a men's fraternity, and that's what they do. That's sort of the demographic that they largely serve. But you've got me thinking that, because I got to say, emotional intelligence didn't come up in the conversation, because I was asking her, how do we ensure that level of longevity? How do we, I don't think we secure in this line of work. I don't think we secure the most significant gifts without that longevity in our own tenure. And so to suggest that, for example, a 23-year-old, for example, right out of college, like some of the young ladies that I teach at the college here at home, they may not be emotionally mature enough to serve the profession really well, I guess is sort of where we're landing here.
Maybe, but at the same time, there's an opportunity for mentorship too, because if we can have people who have been in roles for a long time,
yeah,
that's where you can have an opportunity for mentorship or an apprenticeship or something that helps pull people along the profession in a way that nurtures and helps them to grow.
Yes.
And I think we miss some of those opportunities too because of the turnover.
Someone's
moving from one place to another, by the time you get to a point where you're starting to invest in someone, there's a good chance they're leaving to go somewhere else.
When I was in my first major gift role, I was a gift officer at 20, I think I was 28, 29 years old at a large health charity in Washington. And Danielle was my boss. I talk about Danielle periodically here, and she was probably the most transformative boss that I sort of had early in my career. But one of the things that, and it wasn't a deliberate, it was just a natural outcome of having a boss who we traveled together. And she was, if I was 28, she was probably in her early 40s, and she certainly had that, what we would call that emotional intelligence or that emotional maturity that you're talking about. And I wonder, as we're talking here, it's making me wonder how much of that I sort of gained in a very timely place in my career. That's essentially what you're getting at. She was, and I have shared this with a number of my guests as well. She is an African-American woman as well. So there was certain components of the way that we did the work there together that I think has been very transformative for my career thus far, you know, since then.
Yeah. And I would argue also in that time period of your life, when you're kind of in that 27, 28, 29, like that's a place where a lot of people develop that emotional maturity. That seems to be a real sort of accelerating point for a lot of people, where you move out of kind of more of a childhood way of thinking or a young adult way of thinking into a more mature adult stage of life.
Yes.
And that may make a difference also, because you're more receptive to the lessons and to the coaching that and the mentorship that she had to provide.
Yeah. I mean, she appreciated, interestingly, I think she oftentimes, I remember some of the, and maybe she was just really good at what she was doing, so she made me think this way. I was very confident in the fundraising seat. So she hired me because I was very confident in being in that seat as the direct solicitor who was soliciting that major gift from the person across the table. And at times I have begun to sort of confront the fact that in some ways that was sort of who I was, as, you know, that was some of my privilege as being a white male, perhaps, that she in some ways sort of appreciated, because oftentimes our donors were those same white males. I have oftentimes, I mean, time after time after time, I have said of my first, you know, of the four bosses that I had in my career, she was probably the most transformative, because perhaps she had that emotional maturity that I needed. And then, and the other thing is that she was the one who was most willing to take that mentorship role that you're describing and work so closely with me. None of the other four bosses, the other three were all great bosses. They did great jobs in their own respective ways, but they didn't sit in the role as deliberately. They didn't hop on planes, for example, and travel across the country to solicit a gift. You know, it just wasn't as deliberate and as, we didn't work as close together, I guess you could say.
But that says a lot about her, because she probably did a tremendous amount of work to get to that stage that then she just kind of let you take it, right? Because, I mean, was she had a lot invested in these relationships.
Yes. I mean, I think in some ways, if she was on the call with us, I think in some ways she would appreciate that that confidence that I brought to the table, and maybe confidence isn't the right word, but it probably is. I think she would appreciate that confidence that I brought to the table as that 28-year-old young white male who can step into any setting and probably work, right? Get the job done. But at the same time, I needed that. Any of the we oftentimes had debriefing conversations afterwards. These would be the flights home, I guess you would say, or the drives back from Philadelphia or from, you know, from New York or something. And she really challenged my thinking. And because she was
up for success, she set you up then to be successful, maybe in a way and in a level you wouldn't have otherwise been.
Yeah.
Not to take anything away from your fundraising, but she knew going in that you were, she knew that you were going to be successful at that because she had coached you and guided you along in a lot of ways.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more on that point. I don't think our challenges, I have said this oftentimes, and I suspect you think that, I'm guessing you probably think the same way. I don't think that fundraising's challenges are fundraising. I think fundraising in many ways is actually quite simple. It's really getting those, it's creating an environment where it can be done really well. And it's understanding things like emotional intelligence. And perhaps that's part of the challenge that I have. That's probably some of the critique that I have with some of my consulting peers is that they do major too much on the transaction and on the ask and on the technical side of things, that we don't get into these types of conversations.
But they also don't have a lot of ways, the luxury of that, because they're hired because they're not an employee. If you're a consultant, you're there to do a job. It's understood when people are hiring you that they expect the deliverable to be met. So they're having to work. I understand that they're having to work to hit those metrics. Like, they have to focus on the metrics because they're having to report back to the board that their investment yielded so much. I don't necessarily agree with that, by the way, but I think yes. I understand where they're coming from.
I do too. If you're getting paid, right, if you're getting paid to deliver on technical expertise on how to get a particular transaction to occur, to increase the frequency of those exchanges, if you will, they know how to deliver on those. But I think to sort of bring all this to a close, I think if we think about this, this idea of the profession really maturing as we move into 2021, I think it's going to be less about fundraising, technical expertise when it comes to fundraising, and it's going to be perhaps about a lot of other things. Would you agree?
That's what I think too, because anyone who's been fundraising in this environment will have the mechanics of it down. They'll know the process, but I think it will be what the profession looks like coming out of it. And I'm hopeful that we will make some changes in some areas we need to make it more diverse and more supporting to fundraisers who've been in the profession a long time.
Yeah.
Because I think if 2020 has shown us anything, it is that we need that diversity. We need that inclusion in a way that has not been seen in the profession.
Yes. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Karen, we lose our listeners at about 35, 40 minutes in. If somebody's listening to us, they know how to find me, yep. But they may want to know how to find you. How would you suggest that they do that?
They can find me on LinkedIn.
Okay. And I will put a link to you on LinkedIn in the show notes. And next time you're ready to have this another conversation, you're always welcome. We certainly appreciated your time this morning. You're always welcome on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you so much for letting me talk about some issues that are impacting the profession. It really helps us all if we start talking about it and how we can be more inclusive and let more people come into this wonderful profession.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.